Tonight is the Shloshim for Rabbi Polycarp, so several people asked if we could record this. So the learning tonight should be Ili Nishmoso. This one was one of my wife's teachers in high school. So we wanted to acknowledge that. We're going to try to cover in the next hour the relevant halachas that apply to men for Taharas Mishpacha. I guess a request as we go. If anything is unclear as we're on that topic, please don't be embarrassed. Please feel free to ask and you can clarify anything that's perhaps unclear. But there's nothing wrong with asking. The opposite questions are encouraged. A quick chosen class before marriage, for those of us who got married more than a year or two ago, it's good to have a little bit of review, especially if there was a Baruch Hashem, a child born, where some of these halachas are suspended for a while. So we'll try and cover the main halachas that apply to men. And I think it's important just to start off to make a few simple observations about the halachas of Nida. So they're there, as the Shulchan Aruch talks about, is that in order that when a woman comes back from mikvah, that there's that same excitement and that same cherished that there was at the original chuppah, and of her family that keeps the halachas of Taharas Mishpacha. There's no policeman, there's no one guarding it. But the more the person puts into that and respects the institution of the marriage, and the more meaningful the marriage is. So that's one thing, just to think. So in terms of just in areas of intimacy, those raised in religious environments, so for a large period of one's life, it's not like anything else like Hilchos Shabbos, where we just grew up and we knew what it means to eat kosher, not to eat kosher. For a large area of life, it was just like one big no, nothing happened. And then Hilchos Nida comes in, married life begins, Baruch Hashem becomes like a series of smaller no's, not just one big no. But that quote unquote no is no pun intended, it's a misnomer. It's because the majority of one's married life is not spent while one's wife is in Nida. Certainly for the time when a woman has an active monthly cycle. So even with that, it's not the majority of the month is spent in time in that. And then when one post-menopause, marriage still goes on. There's Baruch Hashem, there's so much more to marriage than just Hilchos Nida. It's important to realize that this is certainly the minority of one's married life, and that the relationship, the marriage, is supposed to be as strong and continue even when the halachos of Nida do apply. So tonight I thought we'll try to divide this up into three major categories. The first thing I wanted to discuss is, number one, how does a woman become Nida? Number two, what applies when a woman is a Nida? And then finally, how does a woman enter status as a Nida and become Tahora to her husband again? I guess the basic general rule is to trust your wife. Your wife has ne'emonis and is believed when we discuss these areas. So let's begin. What's the halacha of Nida? So whenever a woman menstruates, right, whatever her cycle is, then any blood that comes out from the uterus, right, that she has to count the 7 clean days from that, and then without seeing any uterine blood. We'll talk, there's other types of blood that could be seen, but that's not necessarily going to be a problem, right? There's dam Nida, there's dam basulin, there's dam makia. So dam makia means blood from a wound. Any blood that comes from a wound is not going to be a problem. We're concerned about the dam makia. So dam makia could be a complex area. For example, if a woman has hemorrhoids and is seeing blood, so that's not dam. That's not blood that's going to necessarily make the woman into a Nida. Certain OBGYN visits and stuff like that could become complex issues. Certain procedures do not render a woman, like a pap smear, does not render a woman into a Nida. It's always good to schedule these visits, if possible, when a woman is during the period of her Nida, so that way it avoids any complications. But sometimes it can't be. Sometimes something has to be done in that case. So again, it has to be done that comes from the uterus. Not everything, I'm going to go through all the examples, but shilas should be asked before scheduling a visit, if it can't be postponed or rearranged. As to what, then you're going to speak to the rabbi and find out, did it go past the cervix, etc., what type of examination was performed, what type of procedure was performed. But again, that's one thing just to keep in mind. Not all blood that comes, it's only dam nida that comes from the uterus that is a problem, but anything from a wound is not going to be a problem. How does one become Nida? Okay, so we covered the first of all, it has to be dam, it has to be blood, it has to come from the uterus. depends what color shade it is. Not all shades of blood are a problem. It has to be red blood. So that's the brown is not a problem. What is brown? Well, that's the problem. Figuring out what exactly are these different shades and how they relate. So that depends on who takes their shilas to. There's definitely a mesorah that the posek will have as to what shades are considered problematic and how far there's. If there's a red tinge to it, depends how the rav will look at the shilah under what types of lighting could influence it. It has a significant influence on this mara. When a person presents something, whether it's a translucent light, what's the word I'm looking for? Not translucent. Incandescent. I'm sorry, there's incandescent and fluorescent. So they have different types of lights. Some poskim will only look at it unless it's not time sensitive. If a woman's going to mikvah that night, and the rav has to paskin, but some will bedavka wait until the following day to look at it in the sunlight. Some will avoid it. And every rav has his mesoras to how to handle these shilas, but that does make a difference. So the general rule is, again, it's red. Defining red is pretty clear cut. If you're not sure what's red, then that should be taken into a shaila. When I first had Shemesh with Rabbi Neuberger, so Rabbi Neuberger, Baruch Hashem, gets quite a few questions. So he took out a big manila envelope and just spread out 200 maros that came his way that week. He says, these are all browns. Can anybody tell the difference between them? So we just tried. We spent hours just looking through what's brown. And okay, but these are things that if one is not sure, the general rule is, as a takeaway from tonight, is always ask questions. There's no such thing as asking a bad question, asking too many questions. As we enter some of the more detailed areas, we'll see that the questions should be asked, especially when complex situations arise. But again, in general, one should have one more da'asa, one posek that they show their shilas to, because since other rabbonim could have different shilas. I actually have a chaver of mine, but I shouldn't say his name publicly, but he's colorblind. So his wife is trained. So when he gets shilas in these areas, so his wife is trained, you could have such a thing, and she knows what's a problem and what's not a problem. But again, everyone has to have training. This isn't something that we don't just fly off the, you know. But the same sensitivity, lots of times women feel uncomfortable about showing, you know, underwear or videos, anything like this. The same type of discretion that's used by any other professional, by a doctor, where a woman would certainly not have any types of these hesitations. Believe me, it's the Rabbanim are prepared and comfortable in dealing with these areas, and there shouldn't be any hesitation on behalf of a woman, or if she feels more comfortable having her husband present it. But there's certainly no reason not to present these because they feel uncomfortable. Okay, so a few other areas. We talked about how that with the OBGYN that you know, visits should try to be scheduled so that any potential problems could, if women's in units anyways, that's not any problem. For Yoledis, so a woman at what point in the birthing process she becomes Anita is a discussion, but suffice to say, after the baby comes out, then the woman is Anita. So that one should know, if I'm expecting a child, what the halachas are of how to take care of and what point she becomes a Anita. Okay, so there are three different ways as to how the dam could come out. The one, she's bleeding, right? This is what we call, there's a flow. There's an active flow, the dam is coming out. A second way is that there is a spot or a few spots of blood. And the third way is with a bedika, where a woman does an internal examination. Again, there's the flowing, right, which is the period. Then there's spotting, and then there is the bedika. So we'll have to examine. So for a flow and a bedika, the halacha puts those two in the same category. And then in the second, where we have spot or many spots, this is in a different category. So this is a category derabbanan, where there's a flow and an internal examination, where she does a bedika with a cloth, and it's inserted. So that's a deraisa already. But for kesamim, for spots that happen, this is derabbanan. And since it's derabbanan, since the rabbi is the one who instituted this, that we have certain leniencies that apply to the rules of kesamim, to stains, which translate in English, spotting, I guess, that don't apply to the others. So we'll go through the three exceptions as to what if a woman finds a spot. Again, this is not her normal flow, And it's not where she stuck something inside of herself and then found something. This is when a spot is found, either on an underwear, or we'll talk about in the toilet paper, or on the toilet bowl, or whether it's found on the floor, whether it's found on the bed sheets, wherever these spots can be found. What's the halachic status? Question? No? Okay. So what do we have? We have the first concept is what's called gris va'oid. This is the size of the stain. It's only applied if it's larger than a penny. If the stain is larger than a penny, it's a problem. If there's any stain that's found, again, not with the examination, but if you find a stain that's smaller than an American penny, some take a little bit smaller size. Some posts can hold by a dime, but you think it can make all the difference in the world, a dime versus a penny. But the majority posts, certainly in America, hold it that a penny, if Willick holds it, it's a penny, and that's the size that that we're going to do it. What? Yes, it's added up, all those things together. If I was speaking to women, I discussed there is a little bit of a difference as to how we add together this, whether the stain is found on skin versus on a garment. But for our purposes, yes, it's all cumulative, it's added together, and that's the job of the post, like, to try and figure out, you know, connect the dots, no pun intended, but to see if we have a pun intended, okay, fine. But so that's the first thing, gris va'oid. It's only a problem if it's a small amount. It's not a problem. The second area for kesamim is that it doesn't apply if it's found on a beged sevua, on colored garments. It's found on colored garments, so that's why when a woman is not expecting her period, so the post can point out that she should wear colored underwear, and it doesn't help. Sometimes the colored underwear has, on the inside, has a white piece there, so that doesn't help. That ruins everything. You don't want the white to stay as far away from white as possible. If a woman's wearing colored underwear and something happens, even if it's larger than a gris, even if it's quite a large amount, she saw a stain, it's not going to be a problem. Because again, it's on beged sevum. The sheets, the bedroom sheets, should be colored. Some post-skim of Willick holds that should never have white sheets. It's an interesting sheet there, but certainly during this time period, where anywhere it could be, if a stain might occur on bedroom sheets, on a towel or something like this, as long as it's on a colored object, then again, since the whole reason this is only a kesem, this is a derabanan, and the rabbanan set up the guidelines for when something is a problem, when something is not a problem. So that's our second. And the first one is that it's a gris. Question?
Yeah, it's a very light, like a cream color or a...
Don't play games. It. Make sure it's blues and reds and all the because that's a real question. You know, these off whites, the creams and stuff like that. It's better the Rav Willig and others hold. Again, I learned Hilchas Nida with Rav Willig, so what I'm basically saying over is from my Rebbe Shita, but he felt that that avoided at all costs. He felt it avoided.
So does that mean that they're permissible during the Shiva Nakim?
Rav Willig holds not even to use during Shiva Nakim. He says that it's enough to wear a tight fitting white underwear is enough during Shiva Nakim, and that even during Shiva Nakim one is not necessarily required to have white sheets on the bed. And what's our last one? Oh, Davar She'Ein Mekabel Tumah. So this makes sense because if the Rabbanim are saying that this is the way Rabbi Shmuel Marcus explained it to me, he says like this: if the whole point is that the Rabbanu coming along and saying that something is Mekabel Tumah, this woman's becoming tummy now as a result of this kesem she saw, so it doesn't make sense. If something like a floor, karka is not Mekabel Tumah. So if a spot couldn't make the floor tummy, how in the world could it make the woman tummy? So therefore, anything that's not Mekabel Tumah rule kesem. So again, if you saw it on a white floor, even if it was larger than the size of a gris, but it's not Mekabel Tumah, so that's also not going to be a problem. You have to strike out. You have to get all three: the gris, what's the second? What's that? Kalbed beged sevua, and it has to be davar ein shemekabel tumah. So what about a toilet bowl? So a toilet bowl is mechubel lekarka, so that's not a problem. What about toilet paper? So the rule is, we tell the women, do not look at toilet paper. It's a major machlokus within the postgame as to is toilet paper Mekabel Tumah or not. Rav Willick holds it's not, but still, why play games? So if the best thing to do is, and Rabbanim will advise, that one should not have white toilet paper in their house. You should have off-color. They sell the blues, the pinks. What? Okay, so Costco, you know, maybe we'll get like a coalition together asking for some colored toilet paper. But when you think about the, what's the risk, cost risk? I don't know. You get, I think, thank God Jews are not so cheap. We could spend a little bit more on toilet paper. But then that avoids the whole question. That certainly, machlokas, whether or not toilet paper is a problem or not. We tell women don't look, and I'll explain it now, so just I'm on topic. But even if it was on something, if it's colored, then it's not a problem even on toilet paper, right? Because then we knocked it out that way. What do we tell when wiping? We didn't really discuss too much about this, but how a woman could become a nida is she has to have on a deraisa level, she has what's called a hargasha, some sort of sensation. There's different definitions. There's maybe like her limbs start trembling. Maybe she feels an opening of some sort. Maybe there's what some posts can discuss, a wet flow, zivas davalach. So she has to see the blood with one of the sensations. But if a woman is using the restroom, she's urinating, and we're concerned that maybe that masks the sensation. So the post can be very concerned if a woman does, it wipes herself and sees blood right after using the restroom, so we're concerned that maybe that masked the hargasha, and she could perhaps be a shy with a nida now deraisa. So the advice that's given is a woman should clearly wait 10 seconds. 10 seconds after finishing using the restroom before wiping herself. That way we'll be able to differentiate, say that there was no hargasha at that point, that the dam came afterwards. And that's just an etzah tova that comes up. We're talking about the toilet papers and stuff like that. Pads, according to them, again, most posts come with it, it's not makabel tuma. What the biggest, perhaps, I guess, yeah? One of the major issues, and this is really, you know, it's a conundrum, where do you draw the line? We're talking now about seeing spotting. So where do you draw the line between the spotting and the flow and the heavy spotting? So there's really no ironclad rule on this one. Many times it'll necessitate a conversation between the Rav and the family to understand, well, what exactly happened over here as to at what point we make that transition. But again, don't be foolish. If a woman knows, you know, this is how my body is and hormonally, and this is what happens right before I get my period. So then, even if it was just a few spots, one still should. You know, common sense dictates that depending on if there's a prior history, that this could lead to something. Usually, if there is this type of thing, is it starting to the increase? So then the Rav will most often, advocate abstaining for a night just to see what's happening until the situation, so to speak, resolves itself. That's basically, again, that was our first point as to how does a woman become a nida. Was there any questions on that?
The time frame on this, though, the spotting? Is it cumulative for 24 hours? Is it cumulative every time you change your underwear? What is it?
It's not cumulative. No, we don't add together that if something had happened, if a woman changes her underwear and then sees something an hour later, that doesn't add with the previous. It's each one by itself. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now, what applies? I guess the second area. Well, what applies during the time when we just explained how she becomes Anita? So what applies during that time? So the Chazal set up a system of what are called harchakos. What's the shortest word harchaka? Rachok, which means, well, which means what? Far, distance. Okay, so far from what? Far from her. Far from the Aveira, right? So it's interesting. Rabbi Gedalia Berger pointed out that when you ask a group of men what a harchaka is, they'll say exactly that, far from the Aveira. You ask a group of women, what does it mean a harchaka? They'll say, far from me. And that's a very important psychological thing to understand, that obviously both the husband and wife are separate, but the way a woman experiences the time period that she's in need is very different than the way the husband does. And that there's almost like a psychological, I don't want to say a need, there has to be a sensitivity on behalf of the husbands to realize that women are affected during this time period, that again, both men and women have difficulty with abstinence, but the man's not the nida. This is the man that the husband has to be. Again, as we'll talk about what's allowed and what's not allowed during this time period, but it doesn't mean that one's only, again, all physical affection is obviously not there, but it doesn't mean that a husband is distant from his wife during this time period, that there are no on the morning now when she's going to go to the mikveh that night, all of a sudden he starts being friendly again. It's wrong. And the proper hashkafa is that this is also, as we began by saying, this is a period of the marriage as well. There's a time that there doesn't mean there has to be a distance. There are certain harchakos, which will now outline, you know, what they probably, you know, which if you think about it, what is the actual pshat? It's probably like the men said, because you know, the first mission in Brachos, that the harchakos is something that we set up to prevent ourselves from that. But that doesn't change the psychological reality that women do feel that their husband is being distant from them that time. And it's, so really behooves a husband at this point in time to go out of his way to make sure his wife feels loved and cherished, and that aspect has not been interrupted at all by the fact that this is a period when she's in Nida. So I guess we'll outline, I guess, let me go a few general harchakos, and then we'll talk about the difference between basically break down to two other categories, like eating and then in the bedroom. One harchak is to avoid any type of interaction that could lead to intimacy. So in different cultures and different societies, this is very different. Some poskim, again, depending on the culture, is that one should not even say I love you to one's wife while she is in Nida. So again, I don't know if that's... I don't think that's in our circles, but it's different to define. Everything is different. For every couple, you know what leads to it. So if any type of, you know, kalas rosh, joking around and being frivolous with each other, that could lead to intimacy, needs to be avoided during the time period when the couple can't be physically together. Another one of the harchakos is histaklus. So I think perhaps the greatest combination of Torah umada in our generation is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shlita. He's Rosh Hashiva of Gush. I think he's a doctorate from... He was a guy's doctorate like one of Milton's Paradise Lost or something. So they asked Rav Aaron, what's the English translation of the word histaklus? So let's all pretend we're Rav Aaron Lichtenstein for a second. How would you touch the word histaklus?
Gazing.
To gaze. Good. To gaze or to stare. So Rav Aaron said it means to peer. One's forbidden to peer. That's, I think more simply, yeah, like Avi said, to gaze or to look at something. So the histaklus, one should not gaze at the areas of one's wife that are normally covered in her house. So what does that mean? Let's say a woman who covers her hair outside of the home, but when she's alone or no one's around, so she doesn't cover her hair. Or she would never go out of the house without the long sleeve shirt on. But in the house, so she wears short sleeve shirts. So that's not a problem of histaklus. The problem of histaklus is looking at those areas of a woman's body that are normally covered in her own home. Now, it's also important to point that this is on the husband. There is no prohibition of the woman. Obviously, she should be sensitive and realize that her husband is there. But it doesn't mean that she's prohibited from changing in the bedroom. If there's an issue like this, then the husband is the one, if it's a problem, he needs to look away, or he can get up and walk out of the room. But it's not the wife's responsibility to do this. It's certainly on the husband, and again, obviously she wants to be sensitive to this, but it's not you don't shoo her out of the bedroom because she needs to change. You know, if anyone leaves, it's you. What other things? Smelling intentionally. It doesn't matter your wife things, but again, perfume or shampoo, anything, these things that could lead to intimacy should be avoided. And again, sensitivity on the wife's half as well. That's probably not the best time to want to make oneself up and deck oneself out and to do all these things. Smelling perfume. The Piskei Tshuva has a little bit of a suffix about kol isha. Could one listen to his wife's voice while she is in nida? And Ramosha has a tshuva where he says he forbids this. He says one should not do that. However, that's being said, doesn't mean a woman is all types of kol isha, all types of singing are prohibited. If a woman needs to put a child to sleep and sings a little lullaby, so that's allowed. But the regular kol isha of singing. So majority of poskim are machmir on this, that it should be avoided if possible. Another, yeah.
The idea of perfume is perfume for a woman or even cologne for a man?
For a woman. A woman shouldn't wear perfume during this time. Another issue is touching. In addition to physically touching, but garments touching another the spouse's garments would be a problem. Even through clothing, this could come up in terms of traveling or stuff like that, where one should try not to sit next to one's wife if you're on a plane or something like that, and this is your seat, you can't get up, but perhaps an object should be placed in between so that would not be with touching or causing the other to move. Handing other objects to another. So this is a big discussion. I think the Machzor Vitter brings some Rashi, that Rashi did not hand objects to his wife while she was in Nida. So you can't hand something directly to wife, you have to place it down. You can't throw things to one's wife, the car keys. You can't toss your keys or anything like that. Throwing is interesting. Throwing something straight up in the air. You're not throwing it to your wife. One's just tossing something up in the air. So if the wife would catch it, that wouldn't be a problem. That would not be a problem. I don't know if it's a strange way you wouldn't like really coordinate that way, but most often that. Where does this really come up? Comes up with most probably handing objects as a small child or a baby. So this we get. This is where it gets a little bit interesting. So I'll say it like this. Some posts can hold that at least when a child is at the age where they would actively reach out and grab towards the other parent, so then that might not be a problem. In other words, if it's such a small baby, they have no idea who's handling who, so then one should not hand it. Rav Willig, again, has a tremendous quote. Rav Willig thinks that this is mutter. He thinks that there is no problem with handing a baby, because it's like a chole, you can't do this. He says it much more dramatically. He tells these stories he's seen, where people put the child down on the top of the car and walk away, and the old one runs in the catch before it rolls off the hood. So he thinks there's no problem. Rav Schechter, yeah. Toss the baby up, no one has to jump in before.
It doesn't make a difference which way you're handing. In other words, because my baby, when mom hands the baby to dad, the baby grabs mom.
Goes back to
And dad hands the baby to mom, the baby goes and grabs the mom.
I think at that point when they recognize they're being handed to another one, I don't think it would make a difference. I don't think it would make a difference. It would be fine. It would be fine according to that. Rav Schechter writes Lemaisa, though, that it's a very difficult heter to rely upon. That's what Rav Schechter says. But Rav Willig holds it's not a problem.
What's the issue with handing? Is that you'll come to touch? Is that what it is?
It could be, yeah. It's based upon a Gemara in the beginning. It says that there was a certain Talmid Chacham who passed away at a young age. So the Gemara and all the Rishonim are trying to figure out what exactly did he do wrong. So they interviewed his wife afterwards, for the figure out what exactly got your husband. So the way the post can talk about it, it seems to be one of the opinions is perhaps that he handed something that violated some sort of harchaka. The whole harchaka is that it shouldn't come to something intimate. I have to, is that's the issue behind it. Yeah, Don? I'm sorry, Don?
Yes, I don't know if I read it good years ago, but also in public, where did I read this? In the public, because it avoided embarrassment for the woman, to avoid embarrassment?
Yeah, the postgame do discuss that not to embarrass it. Rav Willig felt that that's not. He said, people are paranoid. No one's looking at you. No one really cares whether you put in. And so, they saw that you put the child, instead of handing you, your stroller was here. Instead of handing the baby directly to your wife, so you put the baby in the stroller, and your wife came and took him out of the stroller. So Rav Willig holds that that's not. This whole embarrassment factor, again, you have to use common sense. And
if the Jews right in front of you, the Jews right behind you, lots of groceries.
It's all Zion. That's not the end of the world. No, but again, common sense. If you're at a chasen or something, so you don't walk to right over the mechitza, where your wife is, and then put him down on the floor, and your wife comes up. But again, with common sense, these seems to be an issue. But that's not really such a concern that the Rav Willig didn't think this idea about embarrassing. It was embarrassing. Again, you find other poskim who will do that. There was somebody did some nice shahaya in a particular yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, and the yeshiva came over and screamed at this young man. He says, everyone needs to know your wife's Anita? But again, my feeling is that it's not. They do now, right? In less extreme cases, strollers, getting onto a bus in Eretz Yisrael is an issue. So for that, for a temporary thing like that, when there's nothing else that happens, then that's allowed. Sometimes things could purposely be rescheduled. In other words, if you have picking up a couch or something like that, and you need your wife to carry the other end, she's not allowed to. So if you could reschedule it, you call a friend to come help you move the furniture or something like that, because a husband and wife should not lift the same object. Now again, this is, let's say you made Aliyah. Let's say you made Aliyah today. I don't know. And you get there and your lift is there, and then they just drop it off at your front, your entire life savings is now sitting on the front porch of your house, and everyone just drives away, and now you have to get in the house. So then there are certain heterim, again, if a situation demands that, but it should not be relied upon lechatchila of carrying an object with one's wife. Other things, just practically speaking, you're allowed to put something in her bag. If your wife has the her purse, right? So you're not handing the object directly. You take the car keys and just drop it into her purse. Like Rav Volk says, just be cool about it. Be cool. Drop it in. Those are some of the general issues. I guess we'll...
If she's holding her purse open, can you take the...
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It works well. You could take something out of the purse also as well. You could. Yeah. Okay, so in the bedroom. What applies in the bedroom? Obviously, this is an area of intimacy, so there are certainly harachakos that apply there as well. You can't lie down in the same bed, and the beds cannot touch each other. What's that? No, they can't touch. The beds can't touch, they just cannot touch. You can't have the same headboard also. Sometimes people don't realize that that they get these fancy schmancy beds, and they're two separate beds, but it's one headboard. So the poskim also say that doesn't help. That's considered to be one combined bed. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but obviously if a person, you should not plan family vacations or any sort of getaways during that time of the month, but for whatever reason, a person does have a business trip or something like that, so you have to have a little common sense, and when you're getting a hotel room, you have to ask for queens or twins, not one bed. I know somebody who, they were coming a little bit more observant, and I don't know, I guess they spent like $20,000 on this huge, gorgeous oak bedroom set. Then they found out. So he's like a few weeks, he sleeps on a cot. But okay.
A bad service that captured your kitchen involves the company you just saw.
Yeah. The blowtorch was for the kitchen or for the bedroom?
The blowtorch is to test if you know how long enough in burning
house. There are also times when these halachos to do apply that even when a wife is technically tahara in the bedroom, Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur as well, and also Avelis, but we'll talk about Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. So those the beds need to be separated on those nights as well. Again, in the sheets or what's considered separate enough that you couldn't roll over from one to the other. I don't know if you want to try this at home tonight, but if you flop on the floor. But the beds are so far apart. There's no real, you know, I don't know, 18 inches seems a little bit large to me. Probably even less that it couldn't be. Now what should be in this? There shouldn't be, in terms of tznius, there shouldn't be any recognition as to what a couple is doing. So either the beds should always be apart, or the beds should always be together. And then they're moved when, you know, if you have kids or in the bedroom or whatever it is, or people, I don't know, well, some people don't allow people in the bedroom, but whatever it is, it shouldn't be recognizable to any outsider as to, we'll talk more about when we get to Tevila, but certainly where the beds are, so that's what's going on, that the beds should be set. They should have one set location. And then it's can be moved after everyone else leaves the bedroom accordingly. Okay, what about a moving like a swing or something like...
They're all one set. So in other words, when you make the bed should be made together.
So a husband can't make his wife's bed, and a wife cannot make her husband's bed in his presence. So there's a discussion, what does it mean by making the bed? Does that mean like just, you know, tidying up in the morning? So hopefully a husband's trained now, he knows that to himself. But perhaps it could be the pulling down of the sheets. Some poskim talk about that's like more of an intimate, romantic thing, that can't be done. But perhaps making the bed itself might not be such a problem because it's not such an intimacy and just, you know, straight.
Well, when you say the beds should be set,
one way or the other. Either something will have, they'll have two separate beds, and they'll have like a night table or something in the middle, and the beds are, that's how they are. And then when a couple is intimate, so then one goes to the other's bed. Or the two beds are together. And then when anybody walks in, like kids, I don't know, there's not too many people else are in the bedroom, then at night, then the beds are separated themselves. But it shouldn't be recognizable to any outsider besides the husband and wife. That's what we mean by.
Now let's say you have something like they're always together,
right,
and you have a Shabbos shluf. Do you need to separate? And assuming that the wife's,
you have a Shabbos
shluf in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and assuming you're not lying down at the same time, do you need to separate the beds?
Whoever gets there first. That's the rule.
I don't know what a Shabbos shluf is. So I'm trying. No, okay.
Mastermind.
Yes, yes. If one's wife, if one's wife again.
If one's wife's nidah.
Yeah, then they should
not
be separate.
They're not sleeping.
Still should be separated. Okay. Still should be separated. It could be it's a chumra ba'alma, but that's my eitz. I would still separate. Oh, so what we got about the moving bench. So this is only about Ashkenazim. Sephardim don't have this, but to be on anything like a that where one's movement causes the other one to move, like a hammock, or you know, you have a swing on a porch or something like that. But it could also apply to couch cushions as well, if depending how comfy the couch is. But if a husband's sitting on even on separate cushions, but if his movement on that cushion causes the wife to move or vice versa, that's also prohibited. For Ashkenazim, we have any Sephardim here?
Yeah,
That's like the biggest, you know, they're fun, right? Because you go this way. Yeah, so that certainly is one's movement causes the other one to move on a waterbed. What?
Tempur-Pedic.
I'm not familiar with that.
That's like they drop the bowling ball and it's a glass. The wine glass doesn't even
your movement on one side will have no effect on anyone.
Yeah, it's like
right.
A
film. Guaranteed.
You lie on it and it like makes your impression of your body into it.
It's a separate mattress?
Whatever size mattress you get, but
there's no
one side.
You can't lie down. Well, a husband might can't lie down, depending on how fancy schmancy it is. You can't lie down on the same mattress.
Okay.
He can't lie down on the mattress. He could sit on her bed, not in her presence. That's allowed. A husband could sit on his wife's bed if she's not in front of her. And some for a wife were a little more lenient that she could even lie down, not in his presence. Just make sure I cover everything. Okay, so let's move to eating a little bit. That was the bedroom harchakos, and we'll move to eating. So,
question,
yeah.
To back up, does it matter as far as like if you grab the other one's pillow, or whatever?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Again, you have to know yourself. That's going to lead. Perhaps it's going to lead to something. Then one should be careful. But I think the kapeda is more on the bed itself. I didn't see that openly. This I could look into it, but I don't. I never saw anything about one's pillows. Okay, so for eating again also could be the whole idea is that a husband and wife has a special relationship that doesn't exist between an outsider. So because of that, sometimes we're more lenient with what we'll do with our spouse's food than we would do with a complete stranger. In terms of leftovers, I don't know. I'm not wanting to finish off somebody else's leftovers, but my wife's leftovers, so why not? So the way it works is like this. I'll jump around a little bit, but I'll try to hit all the main points. The way I always was, the way it made sense in my mind is like this. The husband makes kiddush, and then he sends the coast to his wine. So the way to remember is that the wife could have the husband's leftovers, but the husband can't take the wife's leftovers. It's like, that's the way I just always taught it, and it remembered, made sense to me, that since you make kiddush, you take a sip of the wine, then your wife has it after you, so that's allowed. What do you do, though, when you're really not allowed to send it? Because one of the halachas is about pouring drinks for the other, serving the other one. So what do you do if really your wife isn't Nida? So you have two options. Number one, this Rav Willock says you can make kiddush, and then you could put the kos down. You're done. So then you're not giving it to her. She's just taking it on her own. That's not called serving it to her. Or you could pour it into two separate cups, and then if there's people there, whoever takes, just takes, and that's not considered sending your wife. That's not considered giving a drink to your wife. For the minhag in Svar, it only applies to wine. Other things are not a problem, but that's Ashkenazim, so it applies to other things except water. It really holds that the water is not really a chash of a drink, so even that. But how do you get out of this? How do you get around this? Serving. So there's two ways you could do it. You could do it a little bit different. You don't place the drink or the food directly in front of them. You place a little off-center. Or you do it with a shinui, that if you're serving them, you're bringing in the food to them, that it's done with the opposite. If you're righty, you place down with your left hand. You do something in a little bit of a different way. And this only applies to doing it in front of them. And let's say if you're at the one side of the kitchen and you're pouring drinks, so then you pour a drink for your wife. It's not in front of your wife, so that's not a problem. The prohibition is pouring the drink for your wife or to serve it to her directly. You should also not eat together. So just like in terms of milchigs and fleishigs, so we have what's called a heker, something that's a reminder that we shouldn't come to take from the other. And so even when a husband and wife, even though both eating milchigs or fleishigs, we still have to have a heker at the table, something, separate placemats, just like would work like that, so that one shouldn't come to eat. And again, the whole idea is that I'm a little bit more liberal with with the food than I would be with a complete stranger. So that again, these are all harchakos designed to prevent one from becoming intimate. Does this apply when there's others at the table? Do I have to have a hekir when there's others at the table? So most probably not. Depending again, not talking about the little baby infant that doesn't have any idea, but just like a child or something at the table, seated there, then that changes the whole atmosphere. It's not a romantic dinner anymore. So then that would be fine, and these harchakos would not. Sometimes we talk about the woman feeling sometimes awkward or something like that. You know, you have something, you bring out a hekir, something that never comes to the table and only comes out during those times of the month. So it doesn't have to be something that's crazy. You could put it could be like a flower vase or something could be on the table, and that could be the hekir, just as it's reminded. But it shouldn't be something that's being used. In other words, if you're both, you put like a bottle of orange juice on the table, and if you're both taking from the orange juice, that's not called a hekir. Which brings the next point: one's not allowed to eat from the same serving dish directly from it. Let's say you have a bowl of pretzels, a popcorn, or something like that. You both can't take from the same one. You could take it and put it onto your plate, and she could take it onto her plate, but you can't share the same serving dish. And then eating the leftovers we spoke about, but that's only if she's in the room. If she leaves, if she gets up, or she's done, then it's free food. Correct.
So yeah. I'm just throwing out, like you said, with the dish of the pretzels, whatever.
Yeah.
So if I took and then she took, then she can still eat from that.
No, because that's not that. When we say that she gave you love, that means you had your plate of food. And now when you're done eating from that plate of food, then she could go ahead and take from that plate of food. But that's not. Serving dish is a little bit different, because that wasn't yours. That was just everybody's. So you're sharing it.
How do you deal with a bag of chips in the car? You just can't, can you?
Bring little Ziploc baggies. Bring little Ziploc baggies. Right, that's it. You enjoy it while you can. You get the first dibs and then you're done. And if someone else ate from your wife's leftovers, then you're allowed to. So again, imagine you have a slice of pizza or a salad or something like that, and then a child comes in and just grabs it, so then it's gone. It's free. You could have it then. And again, that's only in her presence, and these are just because, in general, husbands and wives are a little more liberal, these things. You wouldn't take from you have a Shabbos guest. You wouldn't ask him, are you going to finish those potatoes or something like that? Well, husband and wife are a little more Hamish, so this is good. One just last final topic on the harchakos, which is again beyond our time for tonight. I want to try and finish up the final segment, is for when the spouse is ill, is sick. So these are a little bit more complex. The harchakos, we assume, are, yes, in place. But again, a shaila should be asked. If a spouse is sick, then these things apply. So let's try and do the final third section, is how does a woman end her status? How does this all end, and how does she become a tahara? So the rule is 5 and then 3, right? She has to wait 5 days while she starts seeing the dam, the blood comes, then she has to count her 7 clean days. So I once heard a story about why it's good always to do a refresher course, that Yomi's cousin is Rabbi Asaf Bednash. He's a genius, one of the super geniuses at YU. So his wife is giving a review course for women, and she said this halacha that it's 5 days, and then you count the 7 clean days. And a woman who married for over 10 years realized she got it wrong all along. She'd been waiting 7 days and then counting the 5. So it's important to, even if again, it's important to spend time and review and to get refresher courses every now and then. So let's work this out. The first thing the woman's going to do on day 5 is the hefsek tahara. That means if she started seeing blood on Sunday, so she's going to do it now. 5 days later, it's going to be Thursday. The hefsek tahara has to be done during the daytime. What does the hefsek tahara do? So she does an examination. She does a clean. Rav Willig recommends that the woman, this doesn't place much of men, so we'll go a little quickly. This doesn't, he recommends doing it in the morning. In the morning, especially, you know, in the winter time when Shkia could come rather quickly. A woman does it then, and if she has time, she could do a second one later on if she remembers, but if she forgets, at least she's good, because you have to have that hefsek tahara to begin the shiv and the kiyum. then that first day of the Bedika, the Hefsek Tahara is day zero. That night will begin the first of the Shiva Nikim. So in our case, it would be Thursday evening will begin the first of her seven clean days. And the easy way to remember is the day the Hefsek Tahara is going to come out, the same night as the Leil Tevila. Okay, so what happened? Lichat Chila, the woman does the Bedika two times. And she wears the white clothing, the white tight-fitting undergarments, as we explained. If for whatever reason, this is very important to know, certain these things can be waived in extenuating circumstances. Whether it's a fertility issue, whether it's a timing issue, whether it's a staining, but shailas should be asked. Because there is grounds under certain cases, one can't decide these on their own, but if one asks a Rav Shaila, then certain of these requirements is to not doing the Bedika, perhaps every, two times a day, perhaps every single day. Other things about wearing the white, they could, again, a shaila should be asked in these areas. Okay, so the tevila is done at night. She does what's called a chafifa. She cleans herself off. She prepares herself. That really ideally is supposed to start during the day and continue into the nighttime. The tevila itself should be done in a private way, which is obviously the act itself, but that people shouldn't know about when one's wife is going to the mikveh that night. It's no one else's business. It's a very big breach of tznius. If, however, somebody needs to know, if it happens to be there's a babysitter or somebody has an in-law, something has to be done. So it's not usur. It's not that we can't tell, but it should be avoided. It really is no one else's business. And if a babysitter figures out on her own, so okay, it's all fine. There's no prohibition against doing it. And again, ideally, it should be done on the correct night, which again, that's not always feasible. Could be you could have maybe an extreme case is the Leil Seder. Woman has a tefillah to go that night, and she has 25 guests coming for Pesach. So, how is that going to work out? Could be something like a wedding. So, maybe they're going away out of town, and there's no mikveh where they're going. Whatever it is, so ideally it should be done on after nightfall on the seventh night. But again, shailas should be asked. It's beyond the scope right now to go through all the different permutations, but it's important to know that. Now again, if a woman is not going to go to the mikveh on the correct time, so that has to be done with agreement of the husband and wife. They have to both be on the same page of this, that it's a recipe for disaster if one side wants to be on one night and one is not willing on the other for whatever reason. So these need to be done in agreement.
Just a quick question, since most at least live here in the Crossway section, so let's say it's Shabbos, whether it's winter or summertime, whatever. But
there's a good plug for the building campaign where we're putting the mikveh next door. Next year.
Until that time.
Yeah.
Is it something that, is a problem then for not to go and, walk back and, obviously, people are walking back out from shore, whatever, back towards home. They're going to see, a woman walking alone. They're going to automatically assume what's what.
A woman, first of all, probably shouldn't walk alone. Certainly at night, it's 2 miles to the park. So a woman shouldn't walk alone. There are ways to work it out. In a private way, I can explain how that could be done. But certainly, a woman should try her utmost best. Certainly, if she's here in town, it's a question of getting to the south side, where the closest mikveh here is for a woman. So then there are ways of working it out that it could be done, not to have to postpone the Leil Tevila. Certainly, if a woman is at that age, mitzvah puravu and other additional factors, so Chazal knew what they were doing, that the way the cycle works for the way a woman ovulates in Leil Tevila, so it's very important to try to go on the night that it's scheduled for, and there are certain ways to facilitate that a woman should go on the correct night. There are some more auxiliary issues, but I don't think it's really relevant for men's setting, but we should know about the vestos. We're not going to really go into depth, but vestos are when a woman is anticipating that she's going to see. So how you calculate the vestos and which ones you keep and when you keep, that's important. The women usually know how these are, but the husband should be aware of it, that it could be, depending on the way the woman's cycle falls out. One, two, three, maybe zero. Sometimes it falls out during the day, so that's not a problem. During the Vestos itself, really only Tashmish, only Bia is forbidden during the actual time of the Vestas. So what about what Harchakos are in place as well? So Rabbi Asher Bush told me, and it makes a lot of sense, I forget who he told him this, but really only those Harchakos that would lead, during the time of Vestas we're talking about, that could really lead to something, hugging and kissing or something that might really lead to intimacy, should be avoided. But then the other things we've been talking about in terms of during the Vestas, about pouring a drink or handing an object, he felt did not need to be avoided during that time. I'm just looking over my notes. I have something about birth control that could obviously affect the Vestas as well. I didn't mention it earlier, but when we're talking about, we tell the woman not to look. So for those couples that have a heter to use the diaphragm, let's say it needs to be cleaned, so we would tell the woman to clean it with her eyes closed, literally, not to look, because if there's any blood that's on the inside of the diaphragm, that's a major shaila. From the outside already wouldn't be a problem, but anything inside, so if she has to clean it. So we for the birth control also, these issues obviously should be discussed with a rav. If there's a heter for the particular couple to use birth control, and then what methods are suggested, but that's beyond, but we just know that does affect Hilchos Nida. I just want to kind of summarize. Is any clear on this last third point, how a woman ends her period of Nidos? Okay, it's important to come and to ask questions, because many times stressful or painful or frustrating situations could easily be avoided. Just by lack of asking the questions, they didn't know they had other options available, that there are certain things that are on the book, legitimate heterim that do apply, could be applied in a particular case, but you don't know unless you ask. And certainly this is a sensitive area, but we have to remind ourselves, we start off by saying that this is a small percentage. It's really less than half of one's married life. So sometimes people get caught up with it and get obsessed, and they don't see the big picture. The big picture is having a healthy, loving marriage. And with all that entails, with the intimacy, being physically close, being spiritually close, being emotionally close to one's wife, and that applies throughout all stages, you know, post-menopause. There is an important halacha that Rabbi Melech Schachter, Rabbi Schachter's father, Zichron Levracha, pointed out, that even after menopause, a woman still is required to go to mikveh. She has the status of a nida until she goes to mikveh. So you could have a woman, very advanced, 70, 80, she technically could still be a nida, if she never went to mikveh after menopause. So he used to tell us over and over again to be mefarsim that. These are all issues that come up, and you know, just like when we started keeping Shabbos, you know, when we first became a big balabas, when we started, it took a few times, you know, of keeping Shabbos to get into a schedule, to get into routine. So Hilchos Nida also works like that. Taras Mishpach also works like that. It's reminding ourselves of what's allowed, what's not allowed, and it's a routine, but it's a healthy routine, and you get out of it what you put into it. If a couple quote unquote cheats, they cheated. No one knows, but your relationship is not as meaningful as it could be. You're cheating yourself. So when we're medakdek and we're careful and we learn and we implement the halachos of this, Chazal knew what they were doing by giving us the most meaningful, beautiful, spiritual marriage that we could possibly have. A physical relationship, they didn't deny this. They recognized that and realized it's a very real part of a healthy relationship. But to do it in a way, we'll close with we like to quote Lubavitch, so we'll close with the words of Lubavitch Rebbe. The Rebbe Zitzal said, if a couple is close when they should be far, then they'll end up being far when they really should be close. A lot of wisdom in those words. Thank you for coming. If anybody has any questions that you want to ask, privately, available, you can call me at my email. And again, I thank you for putting this on recording, because many people who wanted to come tonight were unavailable, but I appreciate everybody for coming out, and wish everybody a Laila Tov.